You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many New Yorkers have told me that they long for a calmer, quieter life, but what would they be willing to give up to get it? Carthusian monks, followers of the most ascetic form of Roman Catholicism, take a vow of silence and live in an austere rural setting, far from the distractions of the world. The Grand Chartreuse, which is tucked away in the French Alps, was the first of these monasteries. Although Philip Gerning first requested to document life there in 1984, he finally received a response in 2001, and the result is a film, Into the Great Silence, which opens today at the Film Forum. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Gerning to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much.
How did you receive word that you finally had permission to film at the Grand Chartreuse?
Actually, it was not 2001, it was 1999. They called me up and sort of very early in the morning and asked, an employee of the monastery asked, are you still interested in doing it? And I was like, well, can I maybe take a couple of days or weeks to think about it? And then it took until 2001 until they finally said yes.
So why do you think the monks decided to allow you to make this film now?
I don't really know. They never gave a real reason why. I think in a certain way, contemplative order has no function towards society except for the function that people should know that it's there, because your life living in New York, as you said, in all the noise, it's different if you know. You also have the you could have the choice to go there, so you could have the choice to be a contemplative monk within our culture.
Well, but wouldn't you be a distraction?
Oh no, you can't go there as a visitor.
I mean you as a filmmaker who had to spend a fair amount of time there.
Yeah, I would be a distraction. On the other hand, they did sort of put up rules. I was supposed to live as the monks do. I was supposed to follow their rituals, keep the silence, and sort of be as unobtrusive as possible.
And you did that for 6 months?
I did that for 4.5 months on one sort of block, and then again for 2 weeks. And all in all, 6 months. It was a great joy.
It was a great joy maintaining all that silence?
Yeah.
I know, as a talk show host, I would find that impossible to do. I have a hard time being quiet in my own sleep.
Well, I can see what you mean, but what happens is that silence, it brings the present moment out so clearly, and it brings the objects and the perception, the sounds, the light, everything becomes so clear, and the present moment just is there, because language always takes us away from that. We have to remember the beginning of a sentence when the sentence ends, otherwise we don't understand it, so the present moment is already gone.
I gather that Rothko was an inspiration when you were editing this for the same reason, because his work is both very much of the moment and yet also allows us to be very contemplative.
Well, Rothko was a real, that was a really good thing to meet with his paintings, because that was in a moment when I was having a very, very hard time in the editing. I mean, editing a film like this, a film that tries to become an experience rather than depict a monastery, it's so hard because it's never been done before, as far as I know. And so I went to this exposition, and suddenly I thought, okay, this guy, he took all the possible risk of sort of going out there into the real void where there's nothing, no construction to help him, nothing, just to sort of try to capture some absolute. And the encouraging thing is he succeeded in doing it. You can look at those paintings, and they deeply touch you even now. So I kept books of his paintings in the editing room after that, because it's when you have the feeling, oh, come on now, I should get some artificial construction in to sort of give the film some structure, and then it's good to look at a painting and think, okay, this guy, he had the courage to do it, so let's try to do it.
Now, why did you even want to make a film about ascetic monks?
That's a complicated, that's a simple question, complicated answer. First, when I first had the idea, I was 25, and I just thought it would do me good to sort of spend some time very quietly with people who concentrate on truth and get away from sort of bustling things. And being a filmmaker, I thought I'd make a film that would take the audience along. And very quickly, I realized that making a film about a silent monastery without speech in the film as well, you move towards something that is very, very much the absolute of cinema, because cinema is also is a very similar place to a monastery. Every outer influence is excluded, time's limited, time's structured, and you get to a film where the core tool of cinema, which is the structure of time, the editing, can take the audience and take it on a trip that goes really, really deep. And I thought, okay, I want to do that.
Although this is mostly silent, we do hear the noises of everyday life. So, but do they ever slip and talk?
Oh yeah, they do. You can see that in the film too. I mean, there's a moment when one brother, he feeds the cats and he talks to the cats all the time. And of course, it's like, was this what San Bruno meant with the rule of silence, talking to the cats all the time? And then monks, they saw the film, and I was afraid that they would ask me to cut this scene, but they sort of said, well, this is good. This is the way we are.
He actually points to one of them and calls and says, he is the boss.
Yeah, he's not pointing at the cat. He's pointing at the blue teddy bear that he has up in that attic. I don't know where he got that teddy bear from, but that's the boss of the cats.
I see. Well, what is their daily routine? Do they keep busy all day?
They have a very strict structure of time. They have like 12 prayers every day, small prayers in cell, 3 big moments in the church. They chop their own wood, they heat their cells, they wash their own clothes, all these things. And then they have very little time left after sort of 8 or 9 hours of prayer. You have very little time left for actual work in the sense that we understand it. And in that time, they do things for the community, or they read holy scriptures or philosophical things.
Isn't this where the liqueur chartreuse comes from?
Yes. So but they are very pragmatic people. They are amazing pragmatic people. So they are still doing that, and they are choosing the plants and all. But the factory, which is down in the valley, has been remote controlled via computer, via internet, since I think 1986, when hardly anybody knew about these possibilities. They had figured out, okay, this is a way of getting us more silent and less time spent in the factory. Let's do it.
But I assume that the sale of chartreuse is what keeps their monastery going.
Right.
Is that typical of all of the monasteries where people take a vow of silence?
No. I mean, there are a lot of Carthusian monasteries. There's one up in Vermont, an American foundation. And the Grand Chartreuse is the only one producing this liquor. And all the other ones, they're producing other things. And basically, they're pragmatic on that. They just try to keep... find a way that would allow them to live in as much silence as possible and somehow survive. And they don't need much money. When you look at the film, you realize the money they need is like minimum.
My guest is filmmaker Philip Gerning, who's into the Great Silence opens today at the Film Forum. They take 4-hour Sunday walks. What's the idea behind that activity?
Well, the order is interesting because it's the only order that was never reformed. So the rules are exactly the same for like nearly 1,000 years now. I guess it was always, they were aware that you need a certain balance between physical activity and thoughtful activity. And it's something to get you moving. And it's also something to, it's an opportunity for them to talk amongst each other, which
they're allowed to talk during these walks.
Yeah, they do. Very funny things, the things they talk to each other. And then in the film, you see them sliding down the hill, too. They're very much like children in that way.
They're playing in the snow.
They're sliding down. They're sort of skiing down on their shoes because they don't have skis, so they just take a very steep hill and ski down.
And what are they hoping to achieve by living this sort of life?
Well, all monks, of course, try to get closer to God or to the higher being in the Buddhist culture. This is what they actually try to achieve. And of course, doing that, any monk will try to become more and more himself or herself. That's what it's about. It's becoming yourself, becoming a free person.
Trappists also have a vow of silence. What's the difference between the Carthusians and the Trappists?
I was thinking about doing the film about the Trappists when the Carthusians sort of simply told me, come back in 15 years when I was there in 86. The main difference is that Trappists are a classical monastery in the sense that people spend their time together all the time. So the morale of following the rule is being enforced by the group watching over you all the time. The Carthusians have a completely different approach. It's this community of hermits. Everybody's on their own. And basically it says, if you don't want to follow the rule in your cell, you can do that. Nobody's going to control that. But you will find out after a couple of years, maybe after 5 years, maybe after 1 year, you will find out that it's not doing you good and you will come back to the rule.
In the film, we meet 2 novices and follow them. This is a way of allowing us to understand what this life is like. We learn with them to some degree.
A little bit. I'm not following them so much. I mean, this is a film where I try to immerse the audience in the experience of a monastery. And of course, in a monastery, you don't learn about a monastery. You learn about that is yourself. So if I were to follow too stringently that one novice, the African novice, you would fall into this sort of informative train of thought. And I want people to go into their own experience. But we do follow them a little.
Well, you said that this film is not to document a monastery, but to be a monastery.
That was the bold ambition I had, and I hope that I'm getting somewhere close to it.
Now, what do you think leads people to choose this kind of life?
Very different reasons. They come from very different backgrounds. Some of them are very, very well educated. Some are not at all. They are very radical people. They are very radical in their choices, and they definitely want to get very close to God. And I think they want to get rid of the stuff that's sort of eating up our time, the useless material things that basically they waste our time.
Well, how could you learn very much about them if you couldn't talk to them very much?
Oh, I could. I mean, on the walks, I went walking with them and I asked them about their background and so on. I didn't include it in the film because I think it's more interesting for a viewer to sit there and wonder, because that brings up the own questions of the viewer.
Did you find this kind of life appealing to you as well?
I did, but I'm too much of an artist to stay there. I mean, you cannot be a filmmaker and a Carthusian. That's not possible.
The film has done very well in Germany. Why do you think this has had such an appeal to German audiences?
Well, Germany was just the first country. It had a great start in Germany. It's been doing great in France, Italy, Spain, all of Europe, actually.
In countries with Catholic traditions, you think that they will
have more
insight?
It's doing great in the UK as well. So it's doing great in the Netherlands. The Netherlands are like the most Protestant country you can imagine. I think it's doing well because it actually seems to give the experience to the audience. It actually seems to let them drift into something that does them well, if you can put it like that.
Well, there is a meditative tradition in cinema.
Yeah.
And that's part of what this is. We kind of experience what it's like, although in a very abbreviated form. Have you shown it to the monks?
I did. I showed it to them in a very small cell on a small beamer because, of course, they don't have a cinema. And half of them watched it, half of them didn't, because we had to change. They had to change the rule for that day. They never have 2.5 hours on one stretch. They always have some prayer between.
Even when they're asleep, do they have to get up to pray in the middle of the night?
Well, there they have a little bit more than 3 hours, you're right. They go to sleep at like 8:38, and then they get up again at a little bit before midnight, have the night prayers and night office in church, and then they go back to bed at 3 and get up at 7.
So they saw the film.
I saw the film.
Did you get any feedback?
They laughed a lot. They laughed a lot more than the normal audience does, because they see so much clearer when the rules are kind of bend, and they enjoyed it very much. And they gave me a little statue in the form of a Oscar, kind of, but in a Carthusian habit. It's a very strange thing that they did. Out of lead, they produced it. Because they loved it very much.
Do you think this film will change the way you approach filmmaking in the future?
Well, in a certain way, of course it does, because the it's such an absolute piece. It does make you look differently at the normal use as a film that you take of filmmaking, the normal use of sort of putting it into the service of a story or whatever. But I've been doing pretty radical films before, and I'm sure that the films I'm going to do afterwards are going to be more radical even.
You have anything in the works?
I have some things in the works, but it's not precise enough yet to speak about it.
Philip Groening's Into the Great Silence opens today at the Film Forum. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. We'll be right back.